School year. School year. Yeah. We'll be back at the beginning of school year next. So probably first Wednesday in September. But I'll contact you guys and let you know. No worries. And I'll certainly announce it at church, just in case nobody realizes we have Wednesday nights for church history. That's okay. Start slow. And I know John and Terry were going to be here towards the end. They're going to try to. So tonight we actually have some pretty interesting ground to cover. And I'm a little surprised we got all the way to the Great Schism, sped through just a little bit there in the late 900s, but that's okay. There's just a lot of horrific stuff that goes on in the 900s. So I figured we could end on perhaps one of the great midpoints, at least from our perspective of church history, and that is the Great Schism of 1054 and the prideful nonsense that happens in that century that caused what nobody expected, a 1,000-year rift between the East and the West. And then the necessity of, and then the distrust of, the Crusades that followed in the generations afterwards. So today we are going to be covering the Great Schism and then the First Crusade. And even before we come to the First Crusade, just kind of Crusades in general. What is the mindset at work? What is the theology at work? What is the politics at work? Why? Because there's a lot of misconceptions about Crusades. And if I can dispel even pieces of that, that would be helpful this evening. Okay, Great Schism. There's a couple of dates in church history you just have to get in your mind. Council of Nicaea, 325. You have to get down that because it's the start of the wrestle between church and state and all this stuff that affects the church for the next 1,700 years and is still affecting the church today and will still go on should the Lord tarry for another several thousands of years, unless something drastic happens to all of civilization. But to be perfectly honest, the amalgam of church and state has survived multiple civilization collapses, so I imagine it just simply changed the way we think about church and state for time and for the rest of this world's age. And so when you think about church history, that's one of the dates you have to keep in mind. 325 is just enormously important. Another really important date is one that we've covered, and that's the crowning of Charlemagne for the Holy Roman Emperor in the year 800, Christmas Day, 800. It's just kind of one of those by reflex you just need to have. The Great Schism. The remarkable thing is that in the year, nobody really knew the significance of what was happening. It looked like a skirmish between two prideful jerks, and because that's what it was. But unfortunately, all sorts of stars aligned to make a rather small occurrence run out of runway and then just plummet off the cliff into insanity to where now the Eastern Orthodox Church and the Roman Catholic Church of today, as well as the Protestant Church, are not reconcilable. Period. And this had been brewing. I've been mentioning it for many months. It has been brewing for centuries and centuries by this point. But the reality is it all comes to a head. The last straw to break the camel's back happens on Easter morning, 1054. That is yet another very important date you need to know in church history. As we go through the centuries to come, obviously you'll have October 31st, 1517, and some other very important dates going forward. That's Luther nailing the 95 Theses on the church door in Wittenberg. We'll get to all of that next school year. So, but the Great Schism. Sure.
The Great Schism is
1064. 1054. Mm-hmm. Yep, nope, 1054. 1060, let's see. What's the thing in secular history? I'm not. 1066 is the Battle of Hastings. I was forced to remember that for some reason in history class, and that's one of the few dates just never left. Oh, no worries. No worries. Okay. So 1054, certainly one of those dates we need to remember because we have the reality is that that is the first place where you and I, from our perspective, will start feeling the effects of church history. As we go off into the world, we run into more than likely Protestant churches. They come in all sorts of different shapes and sizes, Methodist, Lutheran, Episcopalian, Anglican, Baptist, Presbyterian. All of these are Protestant churches. They come out of the Protestant Reformation. That's not even occurred yet in church history where we're at. But they're all part of the Western Church, which at this point has had not had the Reformation. So we trace back to where we are joined together with what is called just simply the Western Church. Later on, it begins to call itself the Roman Catholic Church, and the Protestant denominations are all joined together at this point, and they hadn't split yet. That's what I mean when I refer to the Western Church. The Eastern Church is the Eastern Orthodox Church. Today is an amalgamation of multiple heads of churches, multiple bishops, still with fealty to Constantinople, today Istanbul, still with fealty to Jerusalem and Antioch, and then now there's been many other heads of churches and other bishops added. The bishopric in Moscow was a massive one that, as we discussed in last time I went through church history, may break with the Eastern Orthodox Church and the episcopate in Constantinople. All of that to say is, when we run into Christians that call themselves as such, we don't typically run into Eastern Orthodox Christians. There's a couple reasons why that is. One is the Great Schism. There's not a huge overlap all through church history. And so even when the United States is planted, where you and I all live, you don't have Eastern Orthodox people leaving Eastern Europe or even the extremities of Western Asia. You don't have them leaving there and coming and settling in the Americas. And so what you have in the Americas are largely things influenced by Western Europe, and that would be Spanish Catholicism, and that would be English Puritanism and Protestantism. And so you'll get the Quakers, you'll get the Moravians, you'll get all sorts of these mixtures of Protestant and Catholic. And so in our country, we only ever run into the Western Church almost entirely. Every once in a while, we'll run into somebody from an Eastern Orthodox Church, but it is rare. Now, there's another reason for this, and that is simply by count. After all of these years of separation, the reality is that the number of people who are officially involved with the Eastern Orthodox Church is 250 million. That sounds like a lot of people, but the world is enormous. The Roman Catholic Church, which is only part of the Western Church today, is 1.5 billion. So the Catholic Church is six times the size of the Eastern Orthodox Church today, and Protestants are about 800 million, depending on how you count that, which is remarkably difficult to count that number. House churches, for instance, don't report numbers, and there's simply thousands of them. So when we look at all of this, we realize that the Eastern Orthodox Church worldwide makes up approximately one-tenth of all Christians. And so not having any background in this country, not being from part of this world, and only being one out of every 10 claiming Christians really puts Eastern Orthodox theology into a wheelhouse that you and I are not familiar with on a daily basis. And so their kind of way of life and their call to certain aspects of tradition and liturgy are things that are just simply foreign to us. And it's not just simply the count, but it is the Great Schism of 1054 and the official separation between East and West that makes this the case. One of the unique things about our generation right now is that we're experiencing interaction between Eastern Orthodox, Protestant, and Catholicism all together, all kind of at the same time. And internet is largely to credit or blame for that, not sure, to credit for that, let's put it that way, because it can be used for good. But we're starting to run into issues and we're starting to have questions that we've never answered before, and they're starting to interact with people they've never interacted before, and it has a certain appeal. It's something new. It's something different. And that sits really high in Protestant minds, is if there's something novel, maybe we can do it, especially if it's novel and retro. I mean, those things are just simply amazing. And, you know, when you walk into an Orthodox church, you're stepping back 1,000 years. And so it's something so different that people assume it must be ancient, when in reality it's medieval. Yeah. So that leads to some interesting interactions of this. What are some of the causes that lead up to the Great Schism? Obviously, the history that we've been working through has led a great deal of political and ecclesiastical church differences, linguistic. They still speak Greek, and in the West, man, are they pushing Latin like nothing else. And so as far as for any official interactions, and especially, and we can't really underplay this, when it comes to canon law, when it comes to church rules and liturgies, do not downplay the importance of language, ever. I mean, the idea that this is the way that we've always done church, even if it's the same language, someone comes along and does church a little bit different, people start losing their minds. Now imagine if it's a different language and a different liturgy and a different order and a different set of dress, a different way of look of the sanctuary, a different structure of the front, the altars, icons instead of statues. I mean, simply cultural differences make the separation between East and West really significant. The West's fealty, instead of to the Eastern Emperor, to the Holy Roman Emperor in the 900s and 800s, certainly added to this. The destruction of the papacy in the 900s certainly led up to this. The complete misuse of that office for all of the 900s and the beginning of the 1000s. There was a lot of attempts at reforming the papacy and the monastic kind of order that was settled in this. A lot of it was helpful. Not a lot of it could be fixed, but a lot of it was salvageable, at least. And so there was issues with that. There was distrust from east to west. There was distrust between Eastern bishops and Western Bishop of Rome. I mean, the Pope had added in the filioque clause in their minds. In the reality, it was on his authority that the Western Church could just do this. In the Eastern Church, they're just like, look, we can argue forever and a day whether it's proper to say that, but it's not proper for you to just do that. And if there's any one single cause of the separation between the East and the West, it is the issue of authority. And usually it kind of always comes down to this. Almost every war comes down to this. Almost every disagreement comes down to a concept of authority on some level or another. And this is certainly no exception.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. We have Easter on a different day and all that kind of stuff. Yep.
Was that always?
So there's always been disagreements over these things, right? So in the West, there's less of a let's separate from the Jews than there was in the East. And this will actually come up because one of the issues is over whether we have unleavened bread at the Eucharist or leavened bread. And in the West, everyone was saying, well, unleavened bread, because there's a certain connection to Passover. In the East, there's quite an anti-Semitic concept of the world. Not like you and I run into anti-Semitism. It's just that this idea that the Jews had lost it. They'd lost the blessing of the Lord. Why would we kind of lock arms with that? And so they use leavened bread. They use regular bread. And that doesn't sound like a massive thing, but when it comes down to authority issues of who gets to decide certain things, yeah, any variance in liturgy or tradition becomes treasonous, honestly. Yes, so like our celebration of Easter in the West is based on the Jewish calendar. So we connect it to Passover, which is connected to the lunar cycle. In the East, it's different. Typically, Easter is a little bit later than ours is. Yeah, exactly. And and I'm not even, so this shows even my lack of familiarity with it. I don't even know how they date Easter in the Eastern Orthodox Church. It's connected somehow, but it's distinctly unlinked. And that argument had gone all the way back to the second century. So, I mean, dates for Christmas and things like this, the 12 days of Christmas, I mean, Epiphany, all sorts of this kind of stuff had to be figured out. And when you separate culturally, linguistically, and everything, the ability to come together to kind of figure out the what we kind of see as minutiae, but to them, it really isn't. I mean, they had no idea how long it was going to be that the church was going to continue to exist. How many millions of people were they going to affect? And so, yeah, there was...
Oh, I never made the connection.
Oh, yeah. Yep.
It makes perfect sense.
Yep.
And when we say about separate differences are important, well, it's not important unless it's important to you.
Right, exactly. Exactly. And so this will fold right into the Crusades, because a lot of us go, well, that's not important to us. And it's like, it was to them, and there's good reason for it to have been. And we'll get there too. But yes, good. I'm glad to have so, because that was one of the main struggling points between the East and the West. The East simply had this disdain for all things Judaistic, and the West really doesn't. And so there's not kind of the agreement on that. And when there's not an agreement on that, it can lead to just different liturgies. Different liturgies leads to more distance and leads to more distrust. It's just the way of it. So let's talk about the political side for a second, because I know we're in the church history mode and we're talking about the theological side of it, liturgy and things like this. But the reality is that since the times of Constantine, the political issue has been right there with us. Every time I'm talking about the patriarch in Constantinople, the reality is I've got to talk about the emperor, because the emperor chooses the Patriarch of Constantinople in a number of situations. And so if you have an iconoclastic emperor, well, guess who you're going to have as the head of the Church of Constantinople? You're going to have an iconoclastic head of the church. And so they can excommunicate the person before them, and all sorts of political intrigue can go back and forth. And this has happened multiple times. But the history of the church, as far as its involvement with politics, really does go back to Constantine. Constantine and the church had to work together to figure out how is it that a Christian could be emperor of the Roman world. That changed theology, that changed philosophy, that changed everything for all time. There's just no going back to a time before that. So the church had to answer questions like, when is it right to go to war for a Christian? Because to be perfectly frank, before Constantine, the entirety of the early church was pacifistic. If war came up, we're not to fight in it. Now, we're sitting in a church that's got lists of people that fought in our country's wars in our sanctuary. The early church would find that unbelievably repugnant. But we live in a time where it doesn't even occur to us as that shouldn't belong. I mean, we have American flags here. We have this kind of concept that church and state, while separate, are interlinked, at least on a conceptual basis, and that's kind of how the West works. The East is even more so. The culture, the church, and the country that you belong to are so tied together that they are inseparably linked country by country. And so when you look at the Eastern Orthodox Church, you're not looking at the Eastern Orthodox Church. You're looking at the Greek Orthodox Church, and then you're looking at the Russian Orthodox Church, and then you're looking at the Turkish Orthodox Church, or any of these other places. There's not a Turkish Orthodox Church, but there's subheads and all sorts of other stuff. Anyway, you're looking at all of these things as separate cultural country separation things in the East. In the West, you were looking at a singular Bishop of Rome, a Pope, who essentially ran all of Western Christianity, hierarchical structure, up until the Protestant Reformation. And so you have two completely different structures, two completely different concepts of why is it Rome thinks it has primacy, why is it out here? That's on the church side. But on the political side, we've talked about the effects of the Germanic invasions in the West, the fall of the West, the fact that the Eastern Emperor, let's be honest, they didn't even call themselves the Eastern Emperor. They're just the Roman Emperor, the continuation of the Roman line. There was no real issue with this. We don't look at it that way because we're from the West, and so we call them the Eastern Roman Empire and the Eastern Roman Emperors, or we'll just separate it entirely from that and just call them the Byzantines. But in reality, there is Roman as Constantine, who moved the capital of Rome to Constantinople in the East. That's just the way of it. And so that is the Roman Empire. It is the longest running empire in history. It went for 1,700 years from the founding of the Roman Empire and taking over the Greeks all the way up to 1483 when Constantinople fell. Now, was it enormous? No. At sometimes, yes. Sometimes small. Sometimes big. Sometimes small. And all of these things affected by the political milieu. Another massive thing that happened in the 600s and 700s is the Islamic invasions. This takes over the Holy Land as they saw it. This takes over all of North Africa, all of Spain, and on and off again, parts of Asia Minor. All of this stuff was going on, and people were losing all sorts of heads of the church, all sorts of places. And when you have politics mixed with church, mixed with homeland, mixed with language, mixed with identity, it really becomes a mess. And this is kind of where we settle into the reality of the 1000s. The issues between East and West had become so significant, and the differences between them, and the separations between them, and the linguistic differences between them, and the distances between them, and the difficulty of travel anymore, now that the Roman Empire doesn't have roads connecting it to the Eastern and Western sides. The Germanic invasions, the takeovers, the fealty to the Holy Roman Empire, the betrayal of that to the Eastern Roman Empires, all of these things led to the Great Schism. There is no one singular thing. But the chief of it all, as I said before, is the theological concept of authority. Who has authority in the church? Let's start back at the early church. In the early church, and I'm talking first generation, who had the authority of the church?
The apostles.
The apostles, yep. The apostles had the authority of the church. Everyone agrees with this. East, West, Protestant, Catholic, doesn't matter. We all agree the apostles had the authority in the early church. Why? Because Christ gave it to them directly. They wrote the New Testament. They are the founders of the church. End of story. It is why we pay attention to their writings more than anything else, because that's how God expressed his revelation to his church. Now, from there comes all sorts of breakout theories of apostolic succession, of apostolic founding of cities, and all sorts of things. Some things happen in the book of Acts. Some things happen in the imagination of man. The idea, for instance, of Peter establishing a church in Rome is nonsense. There's no historical backing to that whatsoever. There's not even historical proof that he ever even went there. So that becomes really problematic when you're basing the entirety of the world's church on that broken link of a chain. That's a problem. In the Eastern church, they've got a similar problem. All sorts of cities were claiming to have an apostle found that church there or whatnot. But having an apostle found a church does not make it something special either. What do we see in the book of Acts? We see the apostle Paul founding churches in Thessalonica and Philippi and Ephesus and Miletus and Smyrna, Pamphylia. We've got churches all over the place founded by the apostles. And so that becomes a real difficult sticking point for how apostleship and succession happens. If one could actually argue that Paul invested more in the eldership of Ephesus and Corinth than anywhere else. He lived in Ephesus for multiple years. He interacted with them in the book of Acts. He has an entire book written to them. But then you also have him spending 18 months founding the church in Corinth and writing two whole of the longest books in the New Testament to this church. And yet they're not on the radar at all. Instead, what do we have as heads of the church? Constantinople, which has no ancient historical backing whatsoever. It was created out of thin air in the 330s. That's a remarkable thing, and yet that's seen as the head of the church because it inherited that from Rome. Rome was supposedly led by the Apostle Peter. Yeah. Antioch, we can see that happen in the book of Acts. Makes perfect sense. Jerusalem, makes perfect sense. First council there, Alexandria, Egypt. Simply because of the amount of learning, libraries, philosophical schools, and Christian philosophical schools and colleges. Now, is that how apostolic succession should work? We don't have apostolic succession anywhere in the scriptures. So the real question comes down to, I don't know, where are you from? And that's the reality of this, is your answer to those questions depends a whole lot on the church you're a part of and what country you belong to. And so that becomes a real problematic thing if we're trying to talk about objective reality, because almost everyone can recognize that unless you claim ultimate authority, all of this is subjective on some level or another to try to claim succession one way or another. And if succession does actually occur, who has it? And is that really how this works? So this becomes kind of a problem, because if you're basing authority on succession, as for the apostle ordained this person, who ordained that person, who ordained that person, who ordained that person, it goes all the way down through history, or they're in that office, and then whoever follows that office, because that's what it became in the West. It doesn't matter that there were unbelievers as popes in the 900s and early 1000s, because the office bears the apostolic succession, right? And so this becomes problematic. Well, when the church all says, how are we going to figure out things then? If we all have some version of authority one way or the other, then what do we do when there's theological problems? Well, rise of the Arianism controversy that led to the Council of Nicaea. Constantine calls all the bishops together. How about this? Every single bishop is welcome to come here, settle it down once and for all, bring unity to the empire. Okay, that's tried multiple times. Never brings unity to the empire, and never does away with theological controversies. I literally stood in the presence of my seminary professor who said the Arians were given a bad rap. So did this solve theological controversies? No. No, it didn't. They weren't given a good hearing, I believe is his actual words. Even though it was literally the only subject of conversation for 70 years in the entire empire. But hey, what are you going to do? So all of this to say, one thing that everyone did agree on is if we could all gather together, we could all decide something together. Now, does that make the canons or the creeds infallible in scripture level? Well, that, again, comes back to an issue of authority and whether or not God can do that, not God can do that, or whether or not God did do that, and whether or not we can do that. And so that's where all of these church councils come from. And some of them nuts, and some of them borderline, and some of them good. And so it kind of comes down to, is that authoritative? Are all of them authoritative? Do you get to choose which ones are authoritative? How does it work? It becomes really problematic. One of the things that came out of these were creeds. This is what we believe, the Nicene Creed being the most significant of all of them, actually came out of the Council of Constantinople. The original Nicene Creed was much shorter. The one that everyone quotes is the Constantinople Nicene Creed, and it was established and carried out throughout all the empire, all the churches, everywhere. And then the West wanted to add something. Now, it wasn't that the West just comes up and goes, you know what, it's Thursday again. I think what we're going to do is change the creed. They didn't take this lightly. What they wanted to do was, and the reason why, including in this tiny, it's a singular word, filioque, it means, and the Son. It is a reference to the Holy Spirit, the Lord, the giver of life, who proceeds from the Father and the Son. That's all they added. What they were trying to do was deal with the Arians that were still dwelling in their areas. And so they were saying, look, we have to specify that it's not just from the Father and the Son is begotten by the Father and the Holy Spirit proceeds from. They were seeing as this, it could lead to levels in the Trinity, and we want to protect Christian theology from that misunderstanding. And so for the sake of fighting the Arians, what we'll do is add this little word in here and just make sure of that. Well, that doesn't sit very well with the East. The Eastern Church says, you didn't even ask us. You just did it. And so when challenged on that, the generic answer from the West was, the authority on which we did that was ours. End of story. The Western Church was getting an idea of itself as the head of the whole church. And so being first in honor led to being primary and over. That was a shift extraordinaire, a lot of it having to do with the political and civil unrest and destruction in the West. and a number of other things that we've talked about throughout all these years. So the issue of authority comes down. You have a pope in the West who says, I am the church, I am in charge of it, and when an issue arises, I can speak to it. And that's the end of it. I don't need the Patriarch of Constantinople, and I certainly don't need patriarchs that are in cities occupied by the Muslims. Alexandria, Jerusalem, Antioch have all fallen to the invading forces at this point in history. And so you can see that the schism is not largely about things like leavened and unleavened bread. That's just the symptom of the deeper issue of who's in charge of liturgy and who is in charge of the church. In the West Church says we are in charge of the church. And to their credit, the Eastern Church says we all are in charge of the church. The West was objectively wrong here. It was not in charge of the church. It was never supposed to be in charge of the church. If there was offices that were in charge of the church, it was to be all of them, not one of them. That is clear through how God preserved Scripture. That is clear through how God gave his Scripture. It is clear by the fact that he didn't give us one apostle, but many. He didn't give us one prophet, but many. There's only one place where all of Christianity comes down to one person, and it ain't an office of the pope or a pastor or a bishop. It is Christ himself. Everywhere else, we see multiplicity. And when it comes down to one person, we see abuse and destruction every single time. And so, and that's not a point for democracy. That's a point in how God gave his word. That's a point in how God preserved his word. That's a point in how God even expresses to the local church. It is supposed to be a plurality of elders, not a singular pastor who is unaccountable. That just leads to problems. And we've seen it in the West, because whether or not it was started with good intentions and almost out of a necessity of fallen Rome in the year 600, the reality is that the singular office of the papacy in the West led to issues of authority everywhere in the church, ripples of which finally were paid off 450 years later. And that's where it puts us to. The story that had actually happened was on Easter morning, where two very egotistical crazies, one a representative of the Pope, a guy named Humbert — don't be dissuaded by his name, though it sounds like humble, not even close — and a man named Michael, who was the Patriarch of Constantinople. There in Constantinople on Easter morning, they got into a shouting match over the Eucharist and the nature of the bread on the table. Whose authority this? Whose authority that? And wouldn't you know it, they both had bowls of excommunication prepared for each other. They slammed them down on the altar and excommunicated each other. The Pope, through his legates, excommunicated the Patriarch of Constantinople. The Patriarch of Constantinople excommunicated the Pope. Once that happens, there's nothing left. There's no undoing that rift. And what looked like two jerks doing something that just to drive one another off and to get a one-up in a long-standing set of arguments ended up separating the East from the West permanently. I don't know that there's any way to undo the rift. I don't think there is. I'm not familiar with any theories about how that could even theoretically happen. Now they exist side by side, and there's no undoing that, not as far as I'm aware. You'd have to undo 1,000 years of separate histories. And if there's anything that we hate more than somebody else having a different tradition, it's wiping ours out. And so there's simply not going to be anything that happens along those lines. Nobody at this time considered the effects of this lasting 1,000 years. These little schisms, these little excommunications had happened before, one way, this way. We don't agree that this is the right pope. We don't agree that this is the right patriarch. We think that emperor is an idiot. We think this invasion was wrong. That kind of stuff had gone back and forth. This one was both, now, forever. And it was all over. That year was 1054. If you're familiar with your timeline, you know that that's the same century in which the First Crusade happens. Don't see them as separate. They are connected concepts. connected concepts of a fealty towards and a desire towards helping to maintain certain relationships after these things have broken down. But I will explain through some of the misconceptions about the Crusades how it actually shows forth something a little bit different than most people think it is. So before we move on to the Crusades, I want to ask about the Great Schism. Are there any questions of clarity or just curiosities or anything along those lines before we move forward?
Not related to the schism specifically, but mm-hmm. just thinking about the Church of the East not having the same singular focus on authority that it was in the West.
Mm-hmm.
The churches that existed there in the different countries, states, whatever, they all continued to fellowship and they were all
yep.
good.
Yep. Well, I mean, there's been issues, such as the issue that's currently arising right now between the Russian Orthodox Church and the Ukrainian Oriental Orthodox Church. You know, and every time there's a war that breaks out, they have all sorts of ecclesiastical issues. And so that has occurred all throughout history. But as far as for a staying power of staying in each other's lives and being held accountable by each other, I don't think anyone can fault them for this. They have done a better job than objectively anyone else in Christianity. A lot of reasons why that is. One, they have almost always existed as kind of minority, but they've also always, at least for the past 800 years, but also a lot of them have simply needed each other to survive. And culturally, it really never came down to one person. Culturally, it's nothing like the West. The West has a real bent towards individualism. The East doesn't. It has a much more kind of communal aspect to it. You know, I mean, even their services will be like this. It's not about coming here so that I can have a good experience. It's not even about coming here so that I can learn. It's about coming here to participate in what the churches have been doing for thousands of years. So, now whether that's true or not, I'm not going to get into an argument about, but it's just a completely different mindset. It doesn't work with a single person in charge. It just doesn't. Which is why I would argue it survived all these years for that.
One other culturally related question.
Sure.
In the West, certainly, you know, we see, again, much later on in time, but the huge evangelical moves mm-hmm. by Catholics, Protestants, both. Anything like that happen from the East?
No. So, no. Evangelism like that is a largely and distinctly Protestant. There's a couple of... Right. So now, So you said evangelism. I'm thinking, you know, sharing the gospel and convincing people. I'm not thinking going through and Christianizing entire tribes and so forth and baptisms like that. If you're thinking on those lines, we all of a sudden found out in the age of exploration that the world is filled with savages, and so we need to go save all of them. Some through reason, some through water, some through force. And so that, it's all very convoluted after that. No, the East doesn't really have that kind of a concept. They are usually the ones being taken over, rather than the ones taking over. This is one of the reasons why the Crusades becomes highly necessary, because they had issues on their further border that they simply could not defend. And that's what we're going to talk about next. And that kind of becomes the way of the East. Now, not to mean that they're not the oppressors at times culturally, but the churches don't have necessarily that flair that certainly the West did. My goodness. Between the Spanish conquistadors or between the Spanish Inquisition. Man, there's nothing more Catholic than Spain in the later years there, but that it had a much more militaristic concept about it in the West than in the East. It just is the way it is. Yeah. Sure. Okay, and so when I say that, let me go ahead and dissuade that as one of the misnomers of this. The Crusades were not a simple, hey, I got an idea, let's get a bunch of gold and let's go kill a bunch of people and get a bunch of land for ourselves. It wasn't even Crusades brought together to go do massive things. It was supposed to be a small support army sent to help the borderlands of the Eastern Roman Empire, the Byzantine Empire, from the Seljuk Turks. That's what it started out as. Nobody imagined, including the Pope at the time, what it would grow into. And I'm going to tell you, this is why theology matters. You do not underestimate how significant certain statements about theology become to when you realize that one side statement about one of the ramifications of going on crusades all of a sudden grows it from a few thousand, which was the intention, to 100,000 people. Knights, farmers, people that weren't trained, people that whose life it was to be a mercenary, all of these joined together in Holy Crusade to go help the Eastern Roman Empire. One of the misconceptions. The Crusades was not, hey, I got an idea, let's go kill everyone. This was not first blood, nor was it simple defense. The reality is that the Holy Land had been taken by the Muslim invaders several hundred years beforehand, but it's been in their hands for a long time. That really starts to call into question whether you have legitimacy to take that back. It's been 400 years. 400 years ago in our past is the year 1622. That's a remarkable amount of time to argue that it belongs to us still. Now, theologically, does it belong to the church over the Muslim world? Big questions, that a lot of which is affected by where you live and what country you live in and what things you understand about your own history. And one of the things that we've talked about medieval history, there's not a real linear concept to this. There's a lot of cyclical concept to this. And so that plays its role in here as well. But nothing plays its role in here more than the idea of what a crusade could do. In the first preaching of this crusade, the Pope in the West, Urban II, made it very clear that there would be a playing off of some of the most basic religious concepts that were floating around the world at this time. One is pilgrimage, which is connected very closely to the idea of relics, going and experiencing a land that is itself a relic. Whether we like to admit it or not, even in Protestant circles, we still feel this way about visiting Israel. You go there and you go, my goodness, these stones were here when Jesus was standing on this street. And you get the warm fuzzies about this and all this kind of stuff, right? That is built into the Western mindset. Well, no matter how modern we get, no matter how advanced we get, we will still have this in our background. Pilgrimage is connected to the idea of relics. Also, holy wars. The idea that because church and state are so linked together, especially in the West, we can wage wars that are good. Now, the argument of just war theory has gone back to the time of Augustine. This was already floating around for hundreds and hundreds of years at this point. Most of it was arguing to be a defensive strategy, that it is a good thing to play defense, not to be the offensive one, that just war should be defensive by nature and necessary. Now, those discussions and the lines of those are blurred, especially when literally you make one of the most famous conquerors in the Frankish kingdoms, the Holy Roman Empire. When church and state get linked together with that, it gets really bad down the line, this idea of what exactly makes up a defensive measure. Because as everyone knows who's dealt with war, studied war, or been to war, it gets really messy when you're out on the march. There's not really this kind of clean clarity as to what exactly is happening at any specific point. And in addition to pilgrimages and holy wars, the idea of penance. This is the most important aspect of the Crusades, and I cannot overplay that any more than possible. The Pope, who was preaching the necessity of the First Crusade, included a plenary indulgence if you were to partake in this holy war. A plenary indulgence means a full and complete indulgence. You, upon death, would not go to purgatory. You would go straight to heaven. How do you think that plays in people's ears? The teaching of purgatory had been a part of the world now in the East, or excuse me, in the West for a couple of centuries. It had grown through the dismal realities of the papacy in the 900s and the 1000s into something that was just simply abhorrent. Even to this day, the entire doctrine of purgatory is absolutely ridiculous. Not only did the West make it up, the Eastern Church never held to it, but the Western Church used it to accomplish all manner of things, including the building of St. Peter's Basilica there at the Vatican today. The threat of purgatory became one of the most significant movements in the Western Church, if not the most significant movement that affected so many things, including Crusades. The Crusades would have never happened without the doctrine of purgatory. I want to push that out there and push it pretty hard. We would have never paid attention to a little blip of a few thousand people being a support army on the eastern borders of the Byzantine Empire if it were not for purgatory. What was being attempted was an attempt to support brothers and sisters in the Eastern Church through pity and political favor. What it grew up with, due to the theological teachings of purgatory and the effectiveness of plenary indulgences, is everybody wants to go. Everybody. Even if we're not officially departing yet, we will just go ahead and go without you. In fact, there was a small people's crusade before this that went out and tried to hurry it along. We will see all sorts of manners of crusades going through when we come back in September. But I want you to keep in mind, without purgatory, you do not have the crusades. It is why the Eastern Church, not having purgatory, never came up with the crusades. It is why the Protestant Church, not having purgatory, has never done crusades and cannot do crusades. We don't have the theological framework for it. Only the church in Rome has the framework for such a thing at this present time. Them and Islam. Both have a concept of belongingness and a concept of holy war that is effective towards sending someone towards heaven. Now, as far as for heaven goes in the Muslim world, but a lot of this also comes down for the influence of what the Vikings were expressing as well. This kind of concept that if you die in battle, there is an automatic highway to heaven. Now, is that brought lock, stock, and barrel right into the Catholic Church? No. Does it affect it? Absolutely. There's no way it can't. We are all affected by our cultures. We are all affected by the belief systems around us. It's the things that challenge us. It's the things that make us answer certain questions. My theology looks completely different than it did 15 years ago because I have never answered questions like gay marriage and transgenderism and things like just did not exist for us to address questions in. And yet, here we sit. I have to have developed some of those things and answer some of those questions. And so the way I talk about things is affected by my culture. That happened with them as well. It happens with all of us. This is one of the ways to think about it. This idea of a plenary indulgence being promised to those who took part in crusade swells an attempt for a few thousand helpers to 100,000 people at minimum.
So was the intent of that indulgence to grow those numbers, to make that huge journey?
So asking the intent of somebody 1,000 years ago is a little rough, but I will say this. It was meant to sell something that nobody wanted to do.
Okay, good
enough. And it was really, really, really good marketing. Way too good. And I would imagine the most surprised person about that would have been the Pope. He was not intending for that many people. He was not intending from people all over the Holy Roman Empire. He was not intending for all these knights to sharpen their lances up and go, hey, here's a place that being a knight, I do all sorts of crazy things. You think sailors are bad. We can get a full out for everything we've ever done. Sounds perfect. And I get to kill a bunch of Turks. How amazing. Don't underestimate how significant that was. They all come together. They were to help the Byzantine Empire hold back the Seljuk Turks. So let's spend about 3 minutes talking about the Seljuk Turks, because this always gets dismissed, put aside. The Seljuk Turks came out of the area of Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan, all the way to the other side of the Caspian Sea. They were coming through and riding through all of these Muslim lands. They did not start off as Muslims. At the beginning, they had spent the last 50 years coming from Kazakhstan all the way down to Asia Minor and to Jerusalem area and things like this. They had to take over a bunch of Muslim lands. And you want to talk about how even in conquering things, the people that exist there affect your theology. They became Muslim by lot and large. Most of them did. And so the Seljuk Turks, having come down from Kazakhstan over the past 50 years, were threatening the very existence of the Byzantine Empire. They were taking over lands that nobody had taken over before, ever since the earliest Islamic invasions. And so they were essentially knocking on the door of Constantinople, one of which being the city of Nicaea, right across the Bosphorus, that they actually took. And that's how close they were. We are talking stone's throw from the capital. And the need for support and help was certainly present. This is what I mean when the emperor from the Byzantine Empire reached out to the Pope to request military aid. That should tell you some things. You have control, even if you technically don't have the military, you have the ability to call up a larger army than anyone can imagine. And so through just preaching the crusade and then handing that down to a bunch of local preachers and handing them the promise of a plenary indulgence to partake in it, you constructed a very large army in record time that went to defend Constantinople, to lay siege to the city of Nicaea, and to take it back. This was the way of most of the things that the crusaders did, was lay siege to places. It was the most effective way as far as for preserving lives. Even though we have a plenary indulgence, we don't want to die. It's just by participating in this, not if you die in this. It's participating in this that you go to heaven. And so we still want to be able to provide all sorts of years to do whatever we want. So they laid siege to Nicaea as the first thing. Before they had done this, they were in Constantinople. And because of the size of the army, and they realized that it actually outnumbered the army of the Byzantine Empire, the Byzantine emperor made the crusaders promise an oath first that whatever lands they took, they would give back to the Byzantine Empire and not take for themselves. You can imagine how that worked out. They laid siege to Nicaea. It took a couple of months. They took the whole city. Very interesting. If you want a really almost comedic story to read over the summer, look up the hilarious, and I say hilarious, apologies to everyone who suffered there, but historically it is one of the most comical sieges in history, as that is the Siege of Antioch. The crusaders came and they were unprepared for Antioch. Antioch was a massive city. They did not have enough people to even surround it. And so laying siege to it didn't really work so hot. They were undersupplied and undermanned. And in fact, during the siege, they started starving, not the people inside the city, the people laying siege to it. And if it wasn't for a traitor inside the city opening the walls for them, they would have lost and the crusade would have passed away from its existence and gone back home, partial the size. But a traitor inside the city opened a way for them to come in. They came in to the city and took it over. And then almost immediately, like the next day, a whole amount of backup army from the Seljuk Turks arrived. And the crusaders closed up the city walls behind them. And now they were under siege by the same armies that they had just defeated by laying it under siege. And so it's kind of this... It's kind of a remarkable story. It doesn't end there. You have a guy that's traveling with the crusaders named Peter the Hermit, and so you already know that you're going to have a really cool story. Peter the Hermit has a vision inside the city. While everyone's getting despondent, they're going to lay siege to us. We're already starving. There obviously wasn't hardly any food in the city anymore anyway. But he finds the holy lance, the one that stabbed Christ's side on the cross. And it's a sign of divine favor that not only are we going to be successful here in Antioch, but if God is still with us, then we must continue on to Jerusalem. What better place to bring this holy relic than to Jerusalem, retaking it for Christianity and God? And here's one of the remarkable things when you have all sorts of people traveling with you. Peter the Hermit was an apocalyptic kind of guy. You got to understand, on top of purgatory, this was being seen as essentially the last battle of the end of the world to a lot of these people. Now we look at that and we go, I mean, come on, this is 930 years ago, obviously, they didn't know that. What they knew is that they were being promised eternity. This was the last great battle of the age. We're going to take Jerusalem for Christ. We're going to set up a kingdom there. Forget Constantinople. Forget Rome. Forget all this stuff. We will bring Christ back. That kind of apocalyptic stuff is going to start showing up more and more and more in church history. And it comes down to our very day, where people think that through this or through a lot of the disobedience of the world, Christ is surely coming back tomorrow. And I'm sure you've heard people talking like this. It is an old idea. It's a wrong idea. It's an unbiblical idea. Christ will come back when the Father sends him. This world, meanwhile, is a mixture of good and evil and all sorts of crazy. Stay faithful and endure to the end. I'll take my pastor's hat off and set that to the side. Peter the Hermit finds this holy lance. All sorts of people who are in the crusade sees it as a sign of divine favor that we're going to be successful. And wouldn't you know it, when you get that kind of fire in you, that you have the God of the universe standing behind you, you're able to do all sorts of stuff, including defeating the backup army of the Seljuk Turks who had come to lay siege. And this is what they did. Left the city, took them over, destroyed them, put them on the run, and then continued on past Antioch to Jerusalem and laid siege to the city of Jerusalem. When they come to Jerusalem, they find on the Temple Mount a small mosque there. To Muslim theology, it's the third most holy site in Islamic theology. You've got Mecca and Medina, and then you have the Temple Mount there, which for them is the Dome of the Rock, because that is the place where Abraham almost offered Ishmael. Now, for us, we see the scriptures, and we don't have a perverted, misunderstanding version of him. And we know that Abraham was offering Isaac there, and that the Ark of the Covenant sat there, and that the temple was built around that specific rock for that purpose. And then having it taken over and destroyed and then rebuilt as a mosque doesn't change that reality. Here, the same thing exists. When they come to the city of Jerusalem, lay siege to it, and do take it over, more, let's say, kind of a siege than had been done in the past. When the Romans took over Jerusalem, it was one of the most horrific sights you'll ever hear. When the Crusaders took over Jerusalem, it was a few thousand who were killed, which for a city of that size is actually pretty remarkable. They were quite successful. When they took over Jerusalem, they set up what will be called the Crusader States. This is an entity of several little states and jurisdictions held together by the defense of the Crusaders. And we'll see this transition to this in a second. The Crusader States exist for another 200 years, from the late 1000s to the late 1200s. And they hold back continuing Islamic offense and defense and back and forth, shrink and grow and all sorts of stuff. All of this is based in Jerusalem. And there you have this idea that what had begun with crusade and marching and taking over and taking back now becomes a defensive measure. Now we have to have certain orders of things. We have to have a completely different way of doing things. And so if we're going to be here at the ends of the world, and prepare this for the coming of Christ, we've got to have a special order while you're Westerners. So a special order of monks. We'll make a special order of monks that are also knights. We should call them Knights of the Temple, or shorten that to the Knights Templar. And we'll have to set it up to have it so that these monks have certain specific training and defense and warfare. And so you end up with essentially an amalgamation of monastery, knight training, and I don't know another way to say it, ninja warrior, all there on the Temple Mount in Jerusalem, meant to defend what they took. And it was pretty successful for a long, long time. The Knights Templar, obviously the source of all sorts of conspiracy theories throughout history. A lot of the reason for that is they're so completely different and weird. Also, people who support the Crusades got certain indulgences as well. And so if you're supporting a Knight Templar over there in the Holy Land by gifting them land upon your death and ceding it to them, guess what? They get quite rich, quite wealthy, quite more power. Again, land at this point in Europe, in the western side of Europe, certainly increases your power, your ability, and the Knights Templar was certainly no exception to that. They were a very unusual group, and they gain an enormous amount of wealth and power, and every time you do that, you will have a whole cacophony of conspiracy theorists behind you. But they're really just a very unique part of church history and a unique part of the Crusades in a desire to keep the Temple Mount in possession of the Western Church. Any questions on that? That's a lot of ground to cover.
Okay, so the Seljuk Turks,
yep,
were up in around Constantinople.
Yes, yeah. Nicaea is right across the way from them. Okay, so yeah, that's a good question. Yeah, so at this point, so the Seljuk Turks had taken Jerusalem initially, not Jerusalem, Antioch, and the parts to the north there from the Islamic world. But at Jerusalem was not held by the Seljuk Turks. That was held by the Caliphate at the time. Let's see if I remember their name or if I wrote it down. It starts with an F. Hang on a second. This is not a very familiar. Yeah, the Fatimid Caliphate. And they were largely centered in North Africa. They had their extremities were covering, but like their centers were Egypt and the top of Libya and such. And but their extents, they reached out all the way to Jerusalem. And so it was a little bit less of a struggle to take that from them. It was kind of one of those things. While it was a distinctly holy site, it was also at the edge of a caliphate. And as you know, anything at the edge of an empire anywhere is going to have a hard time defending itself.
So other than both being Islamic, the caliphate and the Turks, they're not?
There's all sorts of differences, yeah. And at this point, there's no unity in the Arab or in the Islamic world. Still the same today. Yeah. You know, and they have... They have a real hard time holding stuff together. The differences between, and if I remember right, I believe the Seljuk Turks, don't quote me on this. It's something sticking in my memory that the Seljuk Turks and the Fatimid Caliphate were different sides of Islam, Sunni and Shiite. I believe the Seljuk Turks came in and they converted to the other side rather than the one that was holding the caliphate there in Jerusalem. So I believe that was one of the reasons why they were also at war with one another. Don't quote me on that because you were really stressing my familiarity with Middle Eastern history of the 11th century. That's a little bit far out for me. But yeah, if I remember coming across something like that. Maybe it wasn't that. They were not friendly to each other, and there were certainly distinct groups, both ethnically and religiously. There was difference. I do know if it wasn't the extreme differences of the Sunnis and the Shiites, it was significant differences elsewise into the kind of Islam that the Seljuk Turks converted into. It was different than the one that was being run by the Fatimid Caliphate. But I can't put my finger on it. Yes. Okay, any other questions? We're going to come to several other crusades. There's going to be a children's crusade. There's going to be all sorts of crazy stuff. The initial attempt, it wasn't just Westerners joining the crusade. There were some of the Byzantine army with them as well. This was a unified crusade, the first one. As history goes on, what begins with good intentions obviously begins to disintegrate as time goes on. By the time we come to the Fourth Crusade, you'll actually have the Fourth Crusade invading Constantinople. Completely different thing when we come to that time period in history. And we're going to see those relationships and those political, societal, and even just theological differences come to the fore. And what started off as a unified force in the First Crusade becomes enemies by the time we get to the Fourth Crusade. And there's a lot of craziness in between. And so that is where we will pick up come September when we come back to it all. As far as for the Great Schism, First Crusade, there's such an enormous amount of differences that are going to set us up for the late Middle Ages. And as we get into some of the absolute craziness of the 13 and 1400s, and hopefully we can get to the Protestant Reformation's beginning day by the middle of October, end of October rather, because that'll be Reformation Sunday, or Reformation Day will be October 31st, 2022. It's always October 31st. And hopefully we can get up to 1517 by then, but I doubt it. That would be moving pretty quick. So we still got all sorts of stuff from the Magna Carta to the rest of the Crusades. We've got, we've got additional Holy Roman Empires that do things. We've got the Avignon Papacy. We've got all sorts of stuff. Yeah, we're not going to make it to that. That's okay. We'll do fine. Unless there's any other questions. Any questions about the first 1,000 years of the church? Yeah, I think we got all figured out. Sweet. It's a good thing Jesus has us. Alrighty. Well, let me go ahead and pray and end us right there, and we'll leave and enjoy the rain a little bit early. Father, we're grateful that you have us where you have us. There's no better place to be than where you have placed us. We know that you have placed us in this culture, in this year, for a purpose. We pray, Father, that we do not spend our lives wondering and worrying about that, but we spend our lives focused on you and being grateful for where you've placed us. We pray that as days ebb and flow in darkness and light, you teach us to be even-handed and even-minded, that we are grateful for what you have given to us, that we are hopeful for the places that are difficult. And Father, that in all these things we place our trust in Christ only, rather than in man, or rather than ourselves, rather than our cultures. We pray, Father, that you bless our summer. Thank you for this entire year that we've been able to walk through these things. Bless our time even as we go home tonight. Keep us safe in the rain and all the flooding that's going on in some of these roads. We thank you for these things in your Son's name. Amen.